Hello, and welcome to the second episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel, brought to you by Hero Collector and their excellent line of hardcover Star Trek graphic novels. This is Jeremy Bewitt, your host, welcoming you, and I hope you enjoyed the first episode. And if you're brand new to Star Trek Panel to Panel, welcome to this episode, and I hope you go back and download the first episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel and check that out as well. In this episode, it's kind of a special episode. I have two interviews in this episode as opposed to normally I just do 0-1 interview, so you're kind of getting a double dose of goodness in this episode. This episode, we'll start out by covering the latest Star Trek comic news, and then we will jump into a review. This episode, we're reviewing the story called The Q Gambit. The story takes place in the Star Trek Kelvinverse, or the 09 movieverse, however you want to call it, whatever you call it. We'll take a look at that series, we'll do a review of it, and then we'll talk to the artist of that story, Tony Shasteen. Tony was nice enough to take some time out of his schedule to chat with me, and since I didn't really know all that much about him, it was nice to learn about him, learn about his craft, and learn about his love of Star Trek. And then after we chat with him, we have a bonus interview. Our bonus interview is with the editor of the Eagle Moss graphic novel line, Rich Handley. Rich took over not too long ago editing the Star Trek graphic novels that Eagle Moss are putting out, these lovely, fine hardcovers, and he spent some time chatting with me as well about his love of Star Trek, how he came into enjoying Star Trek, how he came into his love of Star Trek comics, and how he's become pretty much, I would say, the world's leading expert on Star Trek comics. He has an excellent kind of a info website about all the Star Trek comics that have ever come out since they first started coming out. He will also tell us about the Eagle Moss line, and it was just a really good chat, and I enjoyed chatting with Tony and Rich both, and I hope you enjoy listening to those interviews as well. So with that, let us get into this wonderful episode of Panel to Panel. I don't know about those of you out there who are new to Star Trek Panel to Panel and how big a background you have in way of reading Star Trek comics. I know when the DC got the rights to do Star Trek back in either the late 80s or early 90s when they started doing the Next Generation miniseries and the Classic Trek ongoing series. I read quite a few of those. I really remember reading the Mandala Imperative, which is kind of fortuitous in this episode because we talk about the Q Gambit. But I've enjoyed Star Trek comics off and on over the years. Well, I know there's plenty of storylines and books that I missed out on and runs that I missed out on. And I'm looking forward to going back and reading a bunch of those because I'm one of those kind of people that when I go into something, I go into it whole hog. And Hero Collector is definitely helping me out on that with their line of Star Trek graphic novels. They are reprinting pretty much the entirety of Star Trek comics from the very beginning up to present day. And it's a great way for those of us who don't have all the comics to get into it and get books. And it's kind of like having Christmas every 2 to 4 weeks as you can subscribe to this run and they'll send you a hardcover collected edition. Like I said, every 2 to 4 weeks, you subscribe to them, they'll send you a book, and you can enjoy Star Trek comics anywhere from the Gold Key stuff, which they have collected, they have kind of as background stories or as extras in some of the graphic novels, up to IDW runs such as the Q Gambit that we're taking a look at today. If you go to their website, which is herocollector.com, or you can even do a Google search for Eagle Moss if you want to do it that way, you can see not only the Star Trek graphic novels that they have available and how to subscribe to those and get signed up. You can also see about their line of Star Trek starships and how to get those. They have all sorts of, they have figurines, WWE, they're going to be starting a new line of Batman ones. There's lots of stuff there on their website for you to check out. I highly recommend the Star Trek graphic novels, and I think that would be what you would enjoy if you're listening to this podcast. So make sure you check out HeroCollector.com and tell them that Star Trek Panel to Panel sent you.
Incoming transmission.
In Star Trek comic news for this episode, unfortunately, it's not all that great. due to the whole coronavirus and COVID-19 outbreak worldwide. Diamond Comics has announced that comics that they distribute that were slated for sale on April 1st are not going to be shipped to retailers until further notice. IDW announced suspension of May releases for dates from May 6th through May 27th, and that they're going to reduce their overall publishing line for products originally scheduled through July. It's hard to tell at this point what exactly they are going to release or when comics are going to be released for that matter. So upcoming Star Trek miniseries that was going to be coming out, it's hard to tell if that's going to be released or when it's going to be released. So I guess we'll just have to wait and see. But as I like to say, or like to think anyway, there's plenty of old Star Trek comics out there to read. I know I have a shelf full of books that I've been reading, and I hope everybody else has that as well. You know, there's plenty of stuff. We got years and years of Star Trek comics to look through and read or reread. So now is just as good a time as any, as people are kind of stuck in their homes and practicing social distancing and practicing stay at home. So I hope you all are well out there, and I hope you enjoy listening to this episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel to pass the time. And that is it for the news.
Accessing library computer data.
Today on this episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel, we are going to take a look at a story called The Q Gambit. The Q Gambit was a story that appeared in issues 35 through 40 of the ongoing series of Star Trek from IDW. The ongoing series is the Kelvin Universe timeline that features the cast from the 09 movie. And this story was written by writer Mike Johnson and illustrated by Tony Shasteen. Lettering was by Neil Uitaki, and the creative consultant was Roberto Orsi. Sarah Gatos did the editing. Originally appeared back in 2014, and let me give you a kind of a quick, super quick plot synopsis. I try not to spoil things and go through the whole storyline just because I don't want to ruin it for you in case you want to read it yourself. The premise of the Q Gambit is: the crew of the new Star Trek film franchise encounters the classic Trek villain Q for the first time in this galaxy-spanning adventure developed in association with screenwriter/producer Roberto Orsi. The mischievous Q sends James T. Kirk on a quest that will see the Enterprise joining forces with familiar faces from Star Trek lore. And thank you for Memory Beta for that quick, super quick plot synopsis. Basically the story, the Q shows up in the Kelvin universe and basically kind of has a dispute with Kirk over the Kobayashi Maru, how there's a, Kirk thinks that there is always a no-win scenario. You can always defeat a scenario one way or another. There's always a solution to a problem. And Q basically says, no, that's not true, and I'm going to show you why that's not true, and kind of throws him into this scenario that he has to try to figure out how he's going to beat it. And the neat thing about this story was that he jumps over from the Kelvin universe to the regular Star Trek universe, for lack of a better term, and is able to encounter people or characters that we're familiar with, such as the DS9 cast, and Q, and it's a lot of fun. It's pretty much as simple as that. I really enjoyed this story just because it's always neat when you cross over stuff like this. It's just like in the Doctor Who universe when the Doctor meets one of his or her former selves. It's always a fun story. It's a little bit of fan service, but at the same time, having that from time to time is always a good thing, in my opinion. Star Trek is no exception. You know, when you, even from back in the comic book days of the Mandala Imperative, where you had Classic Trek and Next Generation crossover, it was always neat to see something like this happen, and this story proves that's still true. Even when you are doing something, taking the Kelvin Universe characters and having them meet their future counterparts or next generation DS9 counterparts. Plus, when you have Q in it, Q is always fun. Mike Johnson did an excellent job crafting a story that I thought was a lot of fun, but also at the same time, it's a good solid story. and Tony Shastin's artwork definitely serves this story well. Tony's artwork, he is a very photorealistic type of artist, and for a story like this, when you're using characters or actors that you know, having his style of artwork is the perfect way to service the story. He does a good job of drawing out panels to make it look like camera angles like a TV picture, which makes it feel like you're watching a TV episode, which I really enjoyed. I thought was a good way to tell this story. It has a very interesting ending, one that is neat and gives us Star Trek fans a little bit of a fuzzy feel inside, and I thought it was really good. Make sure you check out this story, The Q Gambit. Today on Star Trek Panel to Panel, since I am taking a look at the story The Q Gambit, what better way to do that than by talking to the illustrator of the story, Tony Shastin. Tony, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Well, I'm new to you, in that I don't know that much about you, so I'm just kind of curious. Let's start off. How did you become interested in being a comic artist, or just an artist in general?
It was one of those things you kind of always know that you're going to get into, just because, you know, you're the one in high school that draws and continues to draw. Knew I was going to go to art school, but then when I went to art school, they basically split you up into either focusing on illustration or graphic design. Sure. Went to the Art Institute of Atlanta at the time.
Okay.
And I went down the I basically split and went into both sides, kind of cover my bases just in case illustration didn't work out.
Sure.
Because I wasn't exactly sure what it was going to be. It wasn't going to be comics at the time. I didn't think I was going to be fast enough to draw comics. Mm-hmm. And I was no place at that level at that point. So I ended up doing both. Pretty much did graphic design for the first more than a decade of my career.
Okay.
And, you know, would do illustration on the side, but slowly got into doing comic covers. But I was told when I was trying to get in, if you don't do sequential work, you're not going to do comic covers, because those are pretty coveted.
Yeah, that's usually the way it goes.
Yeah, I think it's changed a good bit these days, but at the time, that was the case. So I started pushing, trying to get into comics. This is probably 2002.
Okay.
And started doing a creator-owned book. It was called the Occult Crimes Task Force. Came out through Image. And that was when I first got into comics.
Okay.
And then I think, you know, still doing graphic design, still doing comics. And then I think around 2008 was when I did the full shift into illustration work. So okay. That was...
Did you read comic books as a kid? Is that why you kind of were interested in doing that?
Yeah. Yeah. I read all through the 80s. And really in the 90s, I was more into pretty much anything Dark Horse, and specifically Hellboy.
Oh, okay.
Hellboy kind of got me back into comics. So, but yeah, always loved comics growing up.
Okay.
My brother and I always collected. So, you know, we'd go to the comic shop every week and, you know, plunk down our $20 a piece and get, at the time, a ridiculous amount of comics for $20. But yeah, he was the big collector.
Okay.
So, he ended up with, I gave him all my single issues. And, so he still has that collection. I was never as much of a collector as I was just into the art form of comics.
Sure. You said you got started by doing the Occult Crimes Task Force, which for some reason rings a bell to me. I'm sure I ran a comic book store back starting in 2000, so I'm sure I sold some of your issues.
Yeah, it was Rosario Dawson's comic book.
Okay. Yep, yeah, I remember that.
Yep.
How did you get involved with doing that book?
The writer David Atchison and I were friends in Atlanta, and
okay,
yeah, kind of running the same circle. And we talked about doing a book. We'd pitched some books, and we knew Rosario through a mutual friend, and she was interested in doing a comic. So okay, That's how that happened.
Okay. If people are familiar with your work at all, I find it interesting how you said that getting into comics in the 90s, you're really interested into Hellboy. Mm-hmm. And your art style, at least now, is nothing like the Hellboy kind of art style. I was wondering what kind of artistic influences do you have that kind of influence your art style?
I mean, most of the ones I have, I mean, Mignola was a huge influence as far as storytelling,
mm-hmm.
not the specific style, but the way sure. he told the story.
Sure.
And just the graphic look of it. Mm-hmm. So that was an influence, but you know, you can't rip off Mignola. So,
yeah.
So, you know, the other influences I had, like, I grew up playing D&D as well.
Okay.
So, you know, you have those like sci-fi fantasy type influences, like, you know, Larry Elmore, you know, guys like that doing covers, doing those like really rich covers for the books.
Yeah.
So they were a huge influence. But yeah, I mean, Mignola from way back, I mean, even when he was doing like, you know, Far from the Great Mouser and, you know, Rocket Raccoon and things like that. Like, yeah. I was into him way back then. Probably pretty much all the guys that everybody was into back in the late 80s, early 90s. I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't say that any of those influenced my style as much. Mm-hmm. I mean, I tried my best to actually not let any of them influence my style.
Okay.
And just kind of create something that was my own. For better or worse.
Okay.
Most of the style that I've created is just from trial and error on my part.
Yeah. Yeah. From going to working for Image and your first foray into comics to doing Star Trek for IDW, how did you kind of go from point A to point B?
Yeah, point A to point B is definitely right. It's all connect the dots when it comes to the comics uh-huh. and that industry.
Yeah.
So I did, so I went from Image to doing, I did DC work, little projects here and there. I'd pick up, you know, an issue here or there
sure.
or uh-huh. just a batch of pages because somebody fell behind. And
yep.
I was pretty quick. So if somebody was behind, they could come to me for, you know, a lot of work
uh-huh.
quickly.
Okay, sure.
So then I started doing that. So I got in with DC that way. Then I started getting in with, I met Ben Abernathy, who's an editor at DC.
Uh-huh.
And did a ton of work with him. And doing the Rosario Dawson stuff, I was also not just doing comics, but I was also doing likenesses. So if
yeah.
you can do likenesses in comics, you kind of get pigeonholed into that likeness, the likeness books.
Yeah, yeah, so, I can see that.
Which, you know, may be a good thing, maybe a bad thing. I was able to actually work for a long time in comics doing that, but it's not always the most fun, and you're definitely not going to get asked to do X-Men if that's your style.
Yeah.
So the fact that I could do likenesses was a good thing for a paycheck.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it definitely pigeonholes you that way. So because I started with the Rosario Dawson book, I started doing stuff for DC for like Vampire Diaries and Burn Notice. So Burn, you know, okay. the TV show Burn Notice.
Yeah. Yep.
So they had an online comic that was through them that had like this whole interface for your iPad. And it was nuts.
Okay.
So I worked with them for years on that, Ben as my editor. Then I started working with Vampire Diaries. And I had one of the assistant editors was Sarah Gatos at DC.
Okay.
So Sarah went to IDW,
mm-hmm.
and she knew that I could do likenesses, so she brought me on to do Star Trek. So
okay.
that's the yep. connect the dots to get to
sure.
there.
Yeah, you're talking about how doing likenesses kind of pigeonhole you. Well, with you, you do an excellent job of doing likenesses.
Thank
and
you.
I'm a bit of an artist myself, and I was going to ask you kind of about your craft. Do you use a lot of photo references when you do your work? Especially and even now, especially in this day and age where you can pull a screen grab from, you know, whatever movie or TV show you're watching. Is that beneficial for you to do your artwork?
Yeah, absolutely. And you can't be too tied to it, especially when it comes to trying to get emotion across in a character. Because
uh-huh.
sometimes it's tough to actually find photo reference that might be the exact emotion that you're looking for.
Yeah.
But, you know, those are the things that can be tweaked. But, yeah, the fact that there's so much out there for Star Trek was huge. And you need it, because the thing is, you can't just make it up out of your head, because the stuff is being approved by multiple layers of, you know, editorial, you know, with publisher and with Star Trek, CBS, you know, whoever you may be working with. So, yeah, you have to use reference, and you have to get it as correct as possible, because if you're off just a little bit, they'll call you on it. You'll have to redraw it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me jump across now from the art aspect to Star Trek itself. Were you a fan of Star Trek growing up as a kid or young adult?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sorry. I grew up, I was born in 75, so I was watching the movies come out, you know, the original, you know, the motion pictures, stuff like that.
Yeah.
I saw all the original series in reruns, but I remember watching those, you know, Saturdays they would come on, and I would watch them with my uncle and my mom. They were huge sci-fi fans. So, yeah, I watched all the movies, love those. That's really, those were the movies that I really loved.
Okay.
And then The Next Generation. So I was a fan of that as well. So, and then on into Deep Space Nine. I think that's kind of when I started to kind of drift and not follow everything. But yeah, I was a big fan all the way through Deep Space Nine.
Okay. So when you got asked to come to IDW and do Star Trek, so was that kind of a, yay, I get to do Star Trek? Or is it, oh, I'm still kind of stuck in the hole of doing more lightness stuff?
No, it was definitely a yay situation, because I love science fiction. And if I could have drawn that book for the rest of my life, I absolutely would have with that team. Because I absolutely love Star Trek. So yeah, it was definitely a yay situation.
Okay.
And you really get to know those characters in a lot of ways, in weird ways. You kind of get to know the characters better than probably the actors did in a lot of ways, because you spend so much time every day for years with them. So I had quite the fondness for that group of characters.
Sure. Now the story that I'm tying this podcast episode into is the story of the Q Gambit that was written by Mike Johnson. And I know you did an awful lot of work with Mike. What was it like working with Mike?
Mike was great. He's such an easy writer to work with. His scripts are direct to the point. Don't go into too much detail and don't force you to do too much. He basically leaves that, you know, the art direction up to you. So his scripts are as entertaining to read the scripts as it is to read the dialogue in the comic.
Okay.
Just with what he adds to the script itself. I mean, he always said that, you know, the script, if you read a script, it's supposed to be entertaining. And it always is with Mike. Mm-hmm. So yeah, Mike's a good friend of mine. He's, we spent years working together. So
yeah. And you're talking about how he wants to make the story entertaining. Well, the Q Gambit is very entertaining, in that, especially in the fact that it takes the Kelvin verse or the 09 movie cast and puts them into the Next Generation universe. Mm-hmm. First of all, doing Star Trek comics with the movie cast. Since at that time when this stuff was coming out, that was kind of the direction they were trying to steer Star Trek towards, was to get fans interested in the Kelvin verse. Did CBS or the people that had to okay the comics want the likenesses to look as close to the actors as they possibly could? Did you get a lot of feedback, either pro or con, as to your art style? This looks really good. This doesn't look so good.
Yeah, I got a lot of feedback. More in the beginning than once I settled into the book. Not really because my style changed up or my likenesses got better, but I think they're, when a new artist comes onto a series like that and their job is to approve likenesses for the actors, they're essentially the liaison between the publishing company and the actors.
Yeah.
So you have, you know, one person that's kind of the gatekeeper there. They're going to give you a lot more notes early on. And I got plenty of notes in that first run.
Well, that's understandable, especially since you, the majority of your art style very much lends itself into lots of like shots of faces and expressions and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
Which made to me worked very well with the story that Mike was telling.
Yeah, and it works well with Star Trek just because there's not a lot of that, not a ton of physical action as much as it is emotional.
Yeah,
so it's a lot of the close-ups of faces, and you have to get a lot across in those emotions.
Yeah, and in reading the story, it felt very much like watching a TV episode,
mm-hmm.
you know, or like a two-part TV show.
Yep, that's what I tried to do too. I tried to keep camera angles similar to what they would do in the movies or the TV shows.
Mm-hmm. Well, you did an excellent job of it.
Thanks.
I love reading the story just because the story was fun, and two, the your art style lended itself to the story very well. Was it a lot of fun bringing in the cast from like Next Generation and DS9 into the story?
Oh yeah, I mean the fact that you can basically you can bring in any actor at any age into a book,
mm-hmm.
and you know you're not tied to reality in that way. Just being able to get to draw whoever is always a ton of fun. And just being a fan myself, you know, you're checking off a lot of those boxes.
Yeah.
That you have in there, your life goals. So yeah, it's fun.
Since the story, it's been out for a while now, have you ever gotten any wind of if any of the actors that you've drawn, not just in this story, but in doing Star Trek comics in general, have they seen your artwork? Have you gotten any word as to an actor who's like, oh, I really like how this guy draws me or anything like that?
Yeah, here and there. I have a horrible memory, so I can't remember who it was. But I know that there have been, you know, like retweets from actors.
Uh-huh.
You know, on Twitter and things like that. Now I'm going to draw a blank on her name from the latest series, from the Discovery series, the Klingon, Laurel.
Oh, yeah.
Mary Chieftain, I think is her name. God.
Okay, I'm horrible with names, so I'm no help for you on this one.
She was a fan.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, there was a group of the Klingons that really enjoyed seeing what I was doing with them because that focused quite a bit on them in that last series.
Okay. I've asked about how you, the powers that be from like CBS, looked upon your artwork when you were doing, the Q Gambit or primarily the story, but along the lines of doing Star Trek. Did they ever come down and say, oh, we need to change this part of the story? Did you ever have to redraw something, not due to the fact that they critiqued your artwork, but more the storyline?
No, I mean, usually that's taken care of before it comes to me.
Okay.
So they try to make all those notes and Mike adjust those before I actually get the script. So if there's anything that changes while I'm drawing, it tends to be more dialogue-based rather than, you know, the actual scene itself.
Mm-hmm.
There have been a couple of times that we've had to change things, but for the most part, everything's taken care of, you know, prior to that.
Okay.
The one that was based on the Discovery book when it first came out, that one probably changed the most and got put on hold the longest because we just didn't have any of the information. We didn't have any of the – they were shooting it. Like, we would get the actual scripts before they shot the show. We'd get concept art. So I was basing a lot of the early stuff without even knowing what any of the characters looked like. And we were drawing a book about Klingons, or writing a book about Klingons, and didn't even know what the Klingons looked like.
Yeah.
So that was tough. A lot of changes happened to that one. But yeah, for the most part, I mean, a good editor gets in there and, you know, handles that stuff first.
Mm-hmm.
And Sarah was always a great editor. So.
Okay. When you were doing the Q Gambit story, there's plenty of photo reference material out there or stuff that you can grab. I know sometimes the writers of stories, they like sending the artists photo references, like, here's a picture of this that might help you. Does Mike ever do anything like that?
Not really.
He just kind of leaves it up to you?
Yeah, he leaves it up to me. We have some good defining lines about his job and my job, which I think both of us appreciated. And we had a pretty good shorthand too by the end. If there was something that was super specific, I might have to go and ask for reference. But generally, that didn't come from Mike as much as it came from the people at CBS.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite Star Trek cast that you enjoy drawing?
The original series was always great. I grew up with them, so I love drawing them. But I really had a fondness for the latest movie crew.
Okay.
They were great. And you really, when you spend so much time with the characters, like I said before, you kind of get to know them. And you really get to know their faces and their expressions and the way that they're going to carry themselves. So I became a huge fan of the movie crew, the new movie crew.
Mm-hmm.
The Kelvin universe, I guess I should say.
Yeah. Did you find yourself watching the movies over and over again to kind of get the feel of the actors?
Yeah, you have to do that early on. And it seems strange being that it's a comic and it's a drawing, but you really have to know how they react, how they carry themselves. Because, I mean, even when you're drawing someone walking, you need to know how they're going to be walking. I mean, like Spock would walk differently than Kirk.
Yeah.
So you have to actually kind of give them that in the pages as well. So it's a lot of, you know, early on watching, but then once you get a handle of that, you don't have to watch it constantly. If that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. And having to see Chris Pine do the William Shatner swagger as far as like the walk goes.
Right.
You have to kind of do your artist interpretation of that, which
exactly.
I can see that would be kind of tough to do in a panel or two.
Right. Exactly. You know, the way he sits in a chair or something like that, the way he sits in the captain's chair is very specific.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you get those little touches, it makes a big difference.
You did quite a few issues of Star Trek with the movie crew. Is there any plans for you to do more of them?
I think the movie crew one, unless they're doing another movie, it's probably not.
You're done. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you hope to do more Star Trek at some point?
I would. Yeah. I just probably not to get too detailed, but I was essentially just not asked to do any more at a certain point. The powers that be wanted to have fresh blood is what I was told.
Oh, okay.
So from time to time, they just like to bring on a new artist. I was lucky enough to be working with them for, you know, almost 6 years.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you definitely had a good, healthy, long run on Trek.
It's a rarity, yeah. But yeah, when Sarah left, I kind of lost my, the champion over there at IDW. And the new editorial team was not exactly the same as Sarah. And yeah. You know, you get to a point where nobody fights to keep you on the book, and you're no longer on the book.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's kind of the way the freelance world goes.
Yeah.
And but you know, the Q Gambit is a story. I really enjoyed it. Like I said, the story was a lot of fun. I grew up. You know, I was born in 1970, so I'm a little bit older than you. But
okay.
I grew up watching reruns of classic Trek when I would get home from school in the afternoon, and I was big into Next Generation when it came on because that was right during my, you know, late teenage years, and it was fun reading the story and seeing how the movie universe or the Kelvin verse would interact with the characters that are dear to my heart. And your art style definitely captured that TV feel of watching a couple TV episodes, you know.
Oh, thanks. Have you gotten, so you're pretty early on into the Star Trek books right now with the ones that I did, right?
Well, I'm kind of jumping around all over the place.
Couple issues towards, I think it was around 50, where we combined the movie crew with the original series crew.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, Chris Pine, Kirk, and the Shatner Kirk.
Uh-huh.
And the way that those two universes interacted, if you can pick those up, those were a couple of my favorite issues.
Okay.
Because that, to me, truly feels like an episode of one of the shows.
Well, you've just given me something to look forward to, and hopefully I can have you back again at some point in time where we can talk about those.
Sure.
That'd be great. Now, what are you working on currently? Do you have any upcoming books that you want to plug or stuff you're doing?
Doing a creator-owned book right now. I haven't announced
it. Oh, really?
Yeah, I haven't let anything out about it. I haven't shown too terribly much. But, yeah, it's in the works.
Okay. Now that we're, or kind of a final question now, especially it's kind of this, the time with the whole coronavirus, and while it makes it easy for us to chat with each other and do an interview for a podcast, because I'm stuck at home at the moment. How do you feel about the future of individual comics as far as a print media?
I mean, I can't see it going away because, I mean, you think about it. I mean, people have been talking about the end of the comic industry for decades now.
Yeah.
And it's going to change. Like, everything will change. I don't think we're going to know exactly what it's going to be until, you know, we get on the other side of this. But
yeah.
I can't see print comics going away anytime soon because, I mean, if we've seen anything, it's that people want physical comics.
Yeah.
And they always will. And digital is great, but I think it's great as a secondary way to read comics. I'm an old school print guy. I mean, even with my design days, and just there's nothing like actual physical book, physical print, and the smell of it.
Yeah.
Which seems bizarre, but it's true.
It
you
is
walk
true.
Into a comic shop and it's got a certain smell. You know?
I totally agree with you. It's, you know, in all my years of collecting and reading and selling comics, I 100% agree with you on that.
Yeah. And, you know, we'll lose publishers, we'll lose artists, we'll lose comic shops. But on the other side of this, we'll figure it out and we'll get back to a new normal. And then all this will be forgotten at some point, just like all the past pandemics.
Yep, very, very true. So, well, on that note, we're gonna thank you very much for chatting with me, Tony.
Absolutely.
I look forward to reading more of your Star Trek stuff. I'm just like I said, I'm jumping around and reading the Star Trek books, and thanks to Eagle Moss and Hero Collector, they're sending me just kind of random ones, and I'm going through and reading stuff. But I look forward to seeing some more of your Star Trek work, and I look forward to chatting with you again sometime about whatever story I read next that has your stuff in it.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure.
Today on Star Trek Panel to Panel, I have the pleasure of talking to Rich Hanley. Rich, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
The reason I'm chatting with you is you are definitely a Star Trek comic expert, and you are also, I'm not exactly sure what your title is with Hero Collector as far as you're kind of like a curator of their graphic novels for Star Trek. Isn't that kind of what your title is?
Well, I'm the editor. My title is editor at the Star Trek Graphic Novel Collection, but I also write for their Hero Collector website. I have a column every week called Star Trek Comics Weekly, and I write feature articles for them now and then. But my main titles there would be editor of the Star Trek Graphic Novel Collection and then columnist at Star Trek Comics Weekly.
Okay. Well, I guess my first question for you is, how did you get involved in collecting Star Trek comics? I've seen a picture of your office and your vast collection of Star Trek comics. And how did you get started reading them, collecting them, watching the TV show, any of that?
Well, going back before the comics, since you mentioned the TV show, my mother was a first-generation Trekkie. And technically, I watched it in its original run, but I was a year old and don't remember this.
Oh, of course.
I was born in 68, so the final year of the show, I was alive, but, you know, I was also more concerned with, you know, picking up blocks than watching television.
Yeah.
And but we lived in a small apartment, and my mom used to watch the show, so technically I saw the final year. But as I grew up, I got into Star Trek like a lot of people once syndication began. So in the 70s, sure. I watched it from a very young age. And because my mom had watched it and because it was on daily, I used to go, you know, I used to watch it with her and became hooked pretty quickly.
Sure.
That sort of Star Trek was my gateway drug, because I also eventually became a great fan of Twilight Zone and Outer Limits and Planet of the Apes and other things basically that my mom had watched when I was a kid.
Sure.
So I started following it avidly as a child back when the only people who did that were considered geeky. It wasn't mainstream yet.
Yeah.
And, but it was still a great fascination of mine. I started reading the novels and probably around like age 12 or 13. And then one day in the mid 80s, early 80s, I was walking through a Walden Books and I saw a Star Trek comic book on the stands. And on the front, it said New Frontiers. And I was fascinated by what this was. It was a picture of two Spocks mind melding. And I said, what the heck is this? and I picked it up. It was DC Comics Star Trek, very early in the run.
Okay.
The story was fascinating in that it took place after Star Trek III and involved the mirror universe. And this was just amazing to me. I was really curious. So I did something I didn't normally do, which was I bought a comic book. And wow. I came home and just said, all right, I'm already hooked. And next thing I knew, I was I found a local comic book store, put in a subscription for it, and started tracking down every back issue.
Okay.
So that's how I got into it. It was like somebody had handed me meth. So I started collecting everything, and from that point on I've collected every Star Trek comic book that I'm aware of from 1967 to present, and including some rarities that most people probably don't know exist. And then back in the early 90s I started a career as a writer, started off doing stuff for the Star Wars universe, and because the official Star Trek magazine and the official Star Wars magazine were both run by the same company, I started writing for Star Trek Communicator and did their Star Trek comics coverage. And it just sort of went from there. I mean, over the years, okay. I've had a lot of different projects based on Star Trek comics. And then a few years ago, Eagle Moss announced that it was doing the graphic novel collection. And so I wrote to them, which was at the looking back was kind of a ballsy move because they didn't know who I was. But I wrote to them saying, if you need a consultant, let me know. And thankfully, they said, well, yeah, we do, actually. And so I started answering their questions, and that quickly led to my just doing writing for their website, but whatever they wanted me to write about. But that eventually turned into, look, we need someone to write the introductions to these Star Trek books. Would you be willing to write them? And that was a dream gig for a guy who his for whom the introduction to comic books was a Star Trek comic.
Oh, definitely.
So next thing I knew, I ended up writing most of the introductions to the Star Trek graphic novel collection. And then as of volume 71, the editor stepped down and they said, would you be interested in editing from now on? And I said, sure. And now, I came in at 72, we're nearing the end of editing volumes 116 to 120. So it's, you know, I've been there for a while now. It's a lot of fun. I still can't believe that there are currently two companies that produce Star Trek comic book titles and then I'm editing one of them. My mind still doesn't grasp this.
Yeah, it is rather impressive, and I remember when I first heard about the Hero Collector graphic novel collection that started out over in the UK, I was really interested to, because it seems like there's a lot of companies over the years, you know, have gotten the rights for Star Trek comics, and they've put out their own issues and collected them into trade paperbacks and stuff, but I never thought that there would be a company that would be able to get the rights to the whole run of Star Trek comics from, you know, back in the Gold Key days to present, and be able to come up with some sort of collection that would encompass all that.
Well, what made it easier, I would imagine, is that although you would think there would be rights issues from different publishers, but the way that the Star Trek license actually works is that anything published with the Star Trek name on it is owned by Paramount and CBS. So all these comic books are not owned by DC and Marvel and so forth. They're owned by Star Trek. By the Star Trek franchise, by CBS and Paramount. So, if they want to grant a license to a publisher, they can. I'm pretty sure that over the years, other publishers probably had the ability to publish this stuff and just didn't know. You know, because but we have seen some of it. Like IDW reprinted some of the Gold Key stuff. Checker Books published some of the old key. Gold Key. IDW has reprinted the movie adaptations from Marvel and DC. So the ability was always there, but I just think taking on a project like reprinting 50 years worth of comics is probably not something anybody was crazy enough to do before Eagle Moss.
that's totally understandable, especially since you know, not every comic that was put out is an A-plus comic or even a C-plus comic for that matter.
You know, here's the thing. I've reread all of them several times, and now in the course of doing the graphic novel collection, I've had to because I've been writing the introductions. And so I can tell you that while I would love to say that every comic is a city on the edge of forever, the truth is many of them have been Spock's brain. So, but that also being said, there are far more good ones than bad ones. And I think that's the only reason that that they continue after 50 plus years. I was actually speaking about this to someone earlier today. He had said, how long are the gaps in between publishers? But the big surprising thing is that Star Trek comics have been in almost constant publication since 1967. Even though there have been multiple publishers, the gap is usually very short. And I did a spreadsheet to work it out, and it's only four years since 1967 in which at least one Star Trek comic wasn't produced. So, really? Yeah, so it's usually it goes right from one publisher to the next. And so the gaps have been small, but I think the only reason that it's managed to last as long as it has is because the quality has been, for the most part, very good. DC put a lot of great stuff out. Most of DC's work was amazing. Malibu did some great work. Marvel's second run did some great work. IDW has done some stellar work. But I'm also somebody who is easy to please when it comes to Star Trek because those are the runs people would generally praise, but I really like the first Marvel run, the one that only lasted 18 issues before getting canceled.
Oh, yeah.
And I enjoy the hell out of Gold Key, even though the Gold Key run is utterly ridiculous. I'm also the only person I've ever heard of who has a complete run of the British strips, 256 issues that were only published in Britain. I'm sure other people do. I'm not claiming to be the only one. I've just never encountered anybody. And they're just sometimes awful. And you know what? They're wonderful.
I'm the same way as far as like the Doctor Who comics go, since I do a podcast about Doctor Who comics. You know, I've read the vast majority of Doctor Who comics and Doctor Who is one of those that they've had comic strips coming out since 1964, you know, shortly after the series started. And if you read some of those strips and comics that came out back in the 60s, you can definitely tell that they didn't really know the series all that well and that they were just kind of flying by the seat of their pants and putting out a comic that kids would enjoy. And
like
if you compare
the hardcover annuals, for example.
Yeah, exactly. And it's something that if you compare those stories.
Yeah, that's true for Star Trek. The ones in the hardcover annuals for Star Trek from that era are also pretty loopy.
Mm-hmm. And if you compare those to, you know, some of the more current stuff or even stuff from, you know, 10, 15 years ago and compare the stories, you can definitely see how it's kind of grown and become more sophisticated and become more modern or more up with the times. But there's still a certain charm to those older strips.
There's something hilariously fun about, if you know Star Trek well and you know how the characters speak and what the terminology is, there's something really fun about reading a comic strip in which the Enterprise shoots flame out its butt like these battles. There's something really funny about seeing Kirk yelling thunder and space jets or or referring to the Enterprise crew as his men. You know, like it's ludicrous. It's sexist and it's ludicrous and it's not Star Trek, but there's something fun about it. There's something, when you read the very first Marvel series, there's something hilarious about seeing seeing Star Trek's crew meeting the Marvel version of Dracula or running into space gnomes. It's silly as hell, but there's something fun about it that arguably gets lost as the stories get better because once DC came in, the paradigm shifted. DC changed Star Trek comics by making them serious, taking them seriously. And ever since then, the idea of running into Marvel's Dracula or seeing an Enterprise drawn with only four decks, like something ridiculous that an artist would know not to do now.
Yeah.
all that is missing. Now, most would say that's for the better, and I can't disagree with that. I'd rather read a story that's well written, but there's a certain nostalgic charm about reading a story in which the Enterprise crew teaches alien gorillas how to play soccer, which actually happened in the British strip. So there's just something about that that is fun that I kind of miss, you know. But so, not so much that I'd want it to go back to that, because because the better written and better drawn stuff is certainly superior.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah. Now as editor of the range for Hero Collector, are you the one who decides what volumes are going to come out or what story arcs? Or
the reason I got involved with Eagle Moss was that when I'd seen this amazing picture that they'd put out, marketing material of a bunch of books with artwork on the spine that depicted all the various ships. It looked cool. Uh-huh. And the bold claim that it was going to cover every publisher. And I thought, what are the odds that they actually have all this material? It seems unlikely. But as you've seen from my collection, I do. So yeah. I had written to them and said, you know, if ever you need any advice, if you want to make sure you've got everything covered and aren't overlooking anything, and more importantly, if there's anything you simply can't get your hands on and want scanned, let me know. Uh-huh. And so that's how the relationship began. So for the first 71 volumes, I did scanning when needed and then wrote most of the intros. Not all of them. Actually, Robert Greenberger also wrote a lot of them. He was the editor of DC's Star Trek comics. And so the two of us were writing a lot of the intros. Now I'm writing them exclusively because once they made me the editor, it's easier just to have it done in-house.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But from the point that I took over, which was 72, part of my job is to decide what gets reprinted. My goal is to see everything reprinted. I still don't know what the end point on this series is, but I would consider it a shame if we don't get everything done. I would love to be able to say, here are 50 years worth of comics. It would cost you thousands of dollars anywhere else to track this stuff down, because some of them are old and rare, and some of them are nearly impossible to find because they're just so obscure.
Yeah.
But if you get this series of books, you can get all of it.
Exactly.
Will it happen? I don't know, because I don't have any say over, you know, how far the series goes.
Uh-huh.
But while I'm there, I get to choose the content, which is fun, because it's, you know, I got help from a couple of friends who were also reading the books, Wayne Berman and Matt Gilbert. I'm actually going to, when this airs, I'll tag them so they can hear that I said that. But they had done some research figuring out what hadn't been collected, which was immensely helpful to me, because although I had been receiving the books as one of the contributors, I wasn't actively keeping tabs on what was still not reprinted.
Yeah.
So I suddenly had this Herculean task of saying, all right, what's everything they didn't reprint, and now come up with a schedule.
Uh-huh.
So thankfully, Wayne's and Matt's efforts helped a lot in that regard.
Now, how difficult is it to figure out what stuff you want to reprint? And you can't just kind of go through chronologically and reprint it. You have to jump around a bit. How difficult of a challenge is that?
Well, the problem with going chronologically right off the bat is that what do you do if, while you're up to volume 50, IDW publishes a story that takes place 1 week after Kirk took command?
Right? Yep.
So right off the bat, going chronological is impossible because there's no way to predict the future. So I'm really glad Eagle Moss didn't choose to do that. I've seen people say it would have been great if they'd gone publisher by publisher. But the problem with that approach, in my opinion, is that if somebody, for example, doesn't like singling out a publisher, but just for the sake of using one, if someone doesn't like the Malibu run, they might not buy any of those volumes, in which case low sales will get the whole thing canceled. So,
exactly.
So that doesn't work either. So the approach they took is to just sort of jump around. Here's a story from IDW. Here's a story from DC. Here's a story from Tokyo Pop. Here's one from Marvel. And we're going to take the gold key issues and sprinkle them around as bonus stories. So that approach, I think, ended up working. Now, I've just babbled, so I think I lost your question. But your question was, how do you approach?
How do you approach figuring out what stories you want to do, or kind of what variety, how you want to jump around from story arc or publisher to publisher?
Well, the first thing I did, I took Matt's list and Wayne's list, and I compared it to my own and just made sure that I had – that I knew – that. Well, basically, I keep an index to begin with. I have an index of every comic that I just do for my own purposes. So using their lists, I figured out everything that still had a blank spot to it next to it in a column in Excel. And I said, now that I know – so now take all this, and I figured – I made a list of everything that hadn't been reprinted. And I said, all right, assuming the series goes 20 more volumes, I'll try to do this. If the series goes 40 more volumes, I'll try to do this. If the, you know, and so forth.
Yeah.
The idea was to try to wrap up as many as I could, but at the same time offer variety. Like I didn't want to say here are 8 editions in a row with DC in them. I basically went through it and said, here's a storyline from Marvel that really should be reprinted. And here's one from here. Oh, look, here's one of the manga editions from Tokyo Pop that should probably go. And DC should get some more notice. So this way, when people are receiving them in the mail, they'll get a variety. It's
right.
You know, kind of like back in the 70s when people did stamp collecting clubs or recipe card clubs. You never knew what you were going to get each month, and that was half the fun of it.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. Is it a challenge to, like we kind of established, you know, some of the stories are really, really good and some of them not quite so good. Are you kind of putting the volumes together in such a way that, you know, maybe one month the story that comes out is a really good, strong story, and the next month maybe not so much, kind of variety, you know, varying them that direction?
Well, okay, here's the thing. Thankfully, there are more good stories than bad, so which reduces the chance of having, say, 3 crappy volumes in a row, for want of a better way to describe it. Yeah, I was aware of that. I mean, I know that there are a couple of stories that are weaker than others, so I would probably avoid putting them in 2 consecutive volumes. But here's the thing. This is a series that is very much geared towards completists and people who might on the other end of the spectrum might be new to the hobby but want to experience all of it. So that includes the good, the bad, and the ugly. If for a fan who says, I just love the idea of Star Trek comic books, reading about Kirk teaching an alien gorilla to play soccer is hilarious, right? Mm-hmm. So, and if that follows a really sweeping story about the mirror universe, even more fun. It's kind of like when you see a movie and there's an epic battle and 28 people get killed and there's explosions and the next shot is just our hero staring up at the 2 suns from the Tatooine desert and contemplating. Mm-hmm. You need moments like that in between the epic ones to catch your breath. Yep. So I'm kind of okay with the fact that there are some dopey stories mixed in with the bad ones because you appreciate the next really good one even more when it shows up.
Sure.
And in the end, you also have a big variety of storytelling because people reading these books, say, who haven't read the comics themselves, are reading them in a very different way than the rest of us did. I read them issue by issue for each publisher as they came out. Uh-huh. I almost envy the people who are reading these because I have to wonder what is it like for a Star Trek fan whose experience is that, well, today I'm going to read Marvel issues 1-5. Tomorrow I'm going to read DC 1-6. And then I'm going to read this miniseries from IDW. And then I'm going to, like, that. It seems random jumping around, but I think it would be kind of fun, which is kind of what the concept of the series even is, which is, hey, here's another thing you might not have read. Hey, here's another one, you know? So the bottom line is I'm okay with the fact that the quality is going to vary. And I think readers are too, at least I hope, I mean, I haven't spoken to all of them, but I would assume that they're okay with it too, which is why they keep buying it. Because especially for those who haven't already read them, the people who people who have already read them know what they're getting. But the people who haven't already read them, some of this stuff is new, and I would imagine that reading a Gold Key comic for the first time, have you ever read a Gold Key Star Trek comic?
Yes, I have.
Yes, you know. Reading a Gold Key comic for the first time in the year 2020 is probably a very different experience than it was in the 70s.
Oh, most definitely. And it's kind of a shock to the system.
Yes, it is. It is. But, you know, here's the thing about Gold Key. It was fun. Say what you will about them. Yeah, they got things wrong on a regular basis. Sure, every single sentence and every single speech bubble had an exclamation point at the end, which kind of implied that everybody in the crew was always yelling. You know. And by the way, Dayton Warden, Kevin Dillmore, and John Byrne have all done pastiches on the Gold Key series for IDW. John Byrne first in one of his New Visions books, and then Dayton and Kevin in Waypoint, and they're hilarious. They're really hilarious. So you basically we get these two new Gold Key stories done in the 21st century, and but they're hilarious. They really are. And I especially got a chuckle out of what Dayton and Kevin did because they had exclamation. It was the simple fact that they had an exclamation point at the end of every single sentence. Just told me, yeah, these guys were paying attention when they were figuring out what to do.
Yep.
Because it's every captain's log. You know, it's like it's, for some reason, these people are screaming every single line. And that to me was hilarious. So there's a certain fun charm about reading those old stories. And what makes it even funnier is that when those old comics tried to write sequels to classic episodes at a time when they couldn't just call up the episode, chances are they may not have seen it in years, or even if they saw it last month, they can't check the facts.
Yeah.
The resources were extremely limited to Gold Key. And so if they were doing a sequel to, say, Metamorphosis about Zefram Cochrane, that's really damn cool that they did it. And by the way, they did. But they get things like, you know, Nancy's last name wrong, or the name or the name of the nebula wrong, you know, like just because they couldn't look it up. That sort of thing doesn't happen now. Well, if it does now, it's less excusable in any case. But I would imagine for someone reading it for the first time, the reaction might be, what the heck? Nancy Hedron? What is this?
You know, so I think it's neat that Eagle Moss is going through this endeavor of collecting all these books together, and these story arcs together. How are you encompassing or including like one shot issues or things like that into the collecteds?
Well, it depends on the nature of the one shot and on the publisher. For example, just for the sake of argument, because I can't reveal anything that hasn't been announced yet.
Sure.
But like, say, for example, if I were going to publish Marvel's Voyager books. Marvel's Voyager books were largely one-shots, and then there was a miniseries as well. Just one one-shot would make for a very small volume and wouldn't be fair to the fans to give them 70 pages. So,
yep.
So there's an example where you could take, say, three one-shots or a three-issue miniseries and two one-shots or whatever and put them all together. But at the same time, there's also like a Wired magazine did a special issue with a Star Trek comic in it that's never been reprinted anywhere, and so that could be tacked on to the end of something else as a bonus.
It's kind of a bonus thing.
Yeah, Eagle Moss. I have to assume I wasn't involved at the very beginning, so this is an assumption on my part, and if I'm wrong, you understand that I may be totally off.
Yep.
But I have to assume that that their assumption in the beginning was that books entirely containing Gold Key issues might not have sold well, because for whatever reason they took the issues and instead of doing any Gold Key volumes, the entire Gold Key run was done as a series of bonuses at the end of other volumes.
Yep.
I've seen people complain about it, and part of me says it would have been fun to see them collect them just as Gold Key, but I get why they did it, because Gold Key is kind of in a class by itself. It's not like the rest of the stories. But that also opens the door to the other things. Like right now, one of the things, the current batch of volumes we're doing, we're giving the old Power Records Star Trek comics the same treatment. There were six of them. Yeah, like called Passage to Mauve, however the hell you pronounce that.
That's the one I had when I was a kid. I had that one.
So you know, And the Dinosaur Planet, there's a bunch of them. And, well, there's six of them to be exact. And we're giving those the same treatment in the current batch of stories. See, doing an entire volume of nothing but Power Records issues would really be an example of what you said before, a really weakly written volume. Right. Well, yep. You know, like, it, actually, it's not, okay, I'm being unfair there, because I'm actually, the irony is I wrote an intro to one of them about how the reputation that they're badly written is unfair, and here I just said they're badly written. it's because I've heard it so much in my life, I bought into it. But the truth is, some of them are written by Alan Dean Foster and are actually quite good. Uh-huh. It's just that it's easy to forget that they're good because Uhura is a white man, a woman, and Sulu's a black man, and Mares from the animated series looks like an Orion woman decided to paint herself with six different color paints on her. So it's all very strange. I don't know what they were thinking. So if you have a volume that just had that, it would stand out as, here's an example of bad Star Trek. Yeah. And I have to, and since I having made a decision to break up Power Records stories instead of having them in one volume, I have to assume that that's probably the same thought process that the previous editor used with Gold Key. And I get it, because there were 61 issues of Gold Key, but four of them were actually reprinting other stories because I don't think Gold Key even cared. And, yeah. So really we're talking 57. So if you figure that's what, 9 volumes, if there were 9 volumes dedicated just to Gold Key, it might've been a little overkill.
Yeah. Most definitely.
Yeah, but spread out over 57 volumes, it's a constant influx of one Gold Key story to digest at a time.
Yep, and it's a way to get them out there without, you know, overloading it or having those volumes come out first and possibly killing the line of, you know.
And that's the big concern right there, is once you start introducing them, you have to keep going. But if people, because a lot of people hate the Gold Key series, and they may not buy those 9 books.
Yeah.
And you know, the sad truth is sales matter. None of us on the creative end ever want to see that. I'm on both sides of the desk because I'm also a freelance writer. So, and I've been writing since the professionally since the early 90s, and I've been editing since the mid 90s professionally. And I can tell you that the uncomfortable truth about publishing is that sales numbers matter a lot. Yep. That's the unfortunate thing. It should be that creativity matters more, and in my mind, it does. But the decisions whether or not to allow the creative people to keep going, unfortunately, are determined by the bottom line. And in the case of the Eagle Moss books, the reason it's run as long as it has is because people kept buying them. So that it's the kind of thing we have to keep in mind when we choose the content.
Yeah, and
it's a sad reality, you know.
Yep, and it's one of those where. If people aren't buying the books and keeping up with them, you know, Eagle Moss is going to say financially this isn't viable anymore, and then you're not going to have that complete run that I'm sure the diehard collectors are hoping to get to the completion of.
That there's always that danger, and it's something that I wrestle with because I was a fan long before I was a writer or editor. I'm part of a Facebook group that's devoted to the Eagle Moss books, and I've actually said that to them a couple times. I was a fan first.
Yeah.
So, and you've seen my shelves. If I weren't working on these books, they'd still be there.
Yep.
And so I want them to be as good as they can for purely selfish reasons. I want them to go on and reprint the entire series because I want them.
Yeah.
Now, the fact that I'm working on them and getting paid to do so is just icing on the cake, you know? Like, I would still be buying them. I would be buying them if I didn't have to.
Yeah.
And you know, so I want to see this go on forever. Because IDW is going to keep producing comics, and if IDW ever leaves the arena, someone else will step in. I would love to see this series keep going and reprinting them. The sad reality of the fact is there's probably an endpoint, but I'm just going to try to do my best in the meantime to get as much of the material out there as I can until Eagle Moss decides that they're done. Which is, unfortunately for me, not a decision I have any control over. I've had people – I will say that the fans are really enthusiastic about it. There have been, you know, some less so, but a lot of very enthusiastic fans. And I get a lot of questions, and I really try hard to answer them. But one of the questions I often get is, I just don't have – you know, why, for example, an extension is announced, we're going to do 20 more volumes. And someone will say to me, but why are you only doing 20 more? Why don't you keep it going? Uh-huh. You're like, wrong person. Sorry. Yeah. Like, that's not my decision. I cheer when they tell me, here's 20 more. Great. But it's not something I can ultimately say I have any say in. Uh-huh. I can influence and I can cajole and convince, but it's ultimately not my say. That yep. being said, when they extend it, now that's when my job kicks in and I say, all right, well, what do we put in this 20 book extension?
Uh-huh. Well, that's awesome. I'm one of those that I'm a collector at heart, always have been, always will be. And what Eagle Moss is doing with these volumes, I think is wonderful. And it's a great way for, me to do something like this podcast where I can take a book at a time or a story arc at a time and review it and enjoy it and you know, kind of almost study it and learn more about it.
You know, I think one of the greatest strengths that this book series had from its conception is, and I've touched on this before, is that for someone new to step in and be told that there are close to 1,000 Star Trek comic books, plus two entire sets of comic strips, one from the United Kingdom and one from the United States. For someone without this set of books, to try to read all that would be nearly impossible. Sure, there are online sites that illegally have them uploaded and so forth, but the chances of being able to read all of it are pretty slim.
Yep.
And I mean, could you do it? Sure. Could you still own your house when you were done? That's another question, you know, because uh-huh. Even the current stuff. I mean, comics are not cheap these days.
Yeah.
And that's just the new stuff. They're not cheap. I can remember when I first got into comics and they were like, you know, 35 cents an issue, 60 cents an issue. Yep. And I'd like, what? They went up to $1. What the hell? You know, uh-huh. But now, you know, you're paying $3 to $4 an issue, sometimes $5, $8, you know, depending on if it's a special. So to buy all of them would be insane. But to try to track down the Gold Key issues and to track down the first series of Marvel, it gets expensive. To try to track down the newspaper strips and the British strips is nearly impossible.
Yeah.
I know, because it took me more than a decade to do it. I'm a pretty resourceful guy with an understanding wife. Uh-huh. So I managed to do it, but it's not easy. Whereas with this series of books, someone like you, for whom they haven't read a lot of the material before, they can say, oh, this is pretty cool. I you know, this is stuff I wouldn't have found yep. before. And yep. now I have access to it. But it also has a secondary advantage, now that I'm thinking about it, which is that, let's say you choose not to stay with the Gold Key, with the whole series, for example, but you discover you really like DC. Now you know where to focus your collecting if you yeah. want to put on, you know. So yep. there's a definite advantage to this approach. I can only hope that excuse me, I can only hope that the fans are enjoying what I'm doing. I've had pretty good feedback so far that they like the work I've been doing since I came aboard, but you know, it's ultimately up for them to decide. And
yep.
I have a selfish desire to do right by this, because the last thing I want is for my legacy on this series, as someone who's been collecting these since, you know, for decades, uh-huh. is to be the guy who screwed it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, from, you know, as somebody like me who is new to the Eagle Moss volumes and stuff, I've enjoyed what I've gotten so far, and I'm looking forward to working my way through these books. And I think you're doing an excellent job. What I've seen so far, what I've heard so far, and I highly encourage people to get signed up for the program. And it's nice to be able to, you know, get a treat in the mail every so often with a new Star Trek volume and something new to read and enjoy.
Thanks, man. In addition to getting their treat in the mail, for those who are curious about the history of Star Trek comics and how each publisher has approached Star Trek from the standpoint of using comic books to tell prequels and sequels, that's where my weekly column comes in. It's at herocollector.com, which is a division of Eagle Moss. So I'm you know, in addition to doing the graphic novel collection, I also been writing a weekly column now for, I think it's been 40 weeks, because it's every Wednesday morning. And, uh-huh. So I've been going chronologically, whereas the books are jumping around. I started at Gold Key and have been going up to the present and taking a chunk of issues and saying, how did this approach continuity? Basically the idea for that came about because years ago I started noticing while rereading the comics that there were a surprising number of episodes from the various shows that actually had prequels and sequels in the form of comics. And It's more than most people would probably realize in terms of how many episodes have been referenced in the comics. So for someone who's really into trivia, the comics are a treasure because in any given issue, you might see Q pop up, or you might see Sela pop up, or you might see Barkley pop up. You just never know who's going to come in. They'll revisit a station or a planet that that you saw on television. So I started keeping this list of all this material about notes, and that sort of turned into the column, which will keep going until I get up to all the present day stuff. That regardless of what happens with the books, the column I do intend to continue until I'm totally caught up.
Yeah, well, I read the column every week, and I really enjoy it. It's a good history lesson, and. You're definitely very knowledgeable when it comes to Star Trek comics, and I'd like to have you on my podcast every once in a while, and maybe we can review a volume together.
Anytime you'd like, sure.
All right, sounds great. Well, Rich, I want to thank you for joining me today and giving me some kind of insight into what goes into putting together these Eagle Moss graphic novels or collected editions, whatever you want to call them, hardcovers, pieces of art. You know, they're great, and I'm looking forward to going through more of these, and thank you for your time today, and keep up the excellent work.
Much appreciated. Thank you very much.
Transfer of data is complete.
Many thanks to illustrator and artist Tony Shasteen for chatting with me about his work on the Q Gambit, and also talking to me about his career, how he got into doing artwork, and his love of sci-fi and Star Trek. Also thanks to Rich Hanley, who is the editor-in-chief of the Eagle Moss line of Star Trek graphic novels. He is doing some excellent work compiling all those books, and I really appreciated chatting with him and learning about how he got into Star Trek comics and his work. Also, a big, big thanks to Hero Collector. Make sure you go to herocollector.com and get signed up yourself for the Star Trek graphic novel line. I know I look forward to getting a new book from them every so often throughout the month. And it's great to have a new book, a new something to read, a new Star Trek comic story to read. And I think you'll really enjoy it as well. So thank you to Hero Collector for sponsoring Star Trek Panel to Panel. Make sure and check them out at herocollector.com. And last but not least, thanks to those of you out there who are downloading and listening to Star Trek Panel to Panel. Please do me a favor, and if you know any Star Trek fans out there who read the comics, there's got to be plenty of them out there. IDW has been putting out Star Trek comics for quite a while now, and over 10 years. And, you know, if that many people are reading Star Trek comics, chances are they would enjoy listening to this podcast. So make sure you pass this along. Make sure you help the cause, and make sure you mention this to all your friends who are Star Trek fans. And thank you for listening. Thank you for downloading this episode. And until next time, this is Jeremy Bement saying bye. Thank you for downloading this episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel, the Internet's premier podcast about Star Trek comics. You can find us on Facebook at Star Trek Panel to Panel and on Twitter at Star Trek P2P, 2 being the number 2. You can always find Star Trek Panel to Panel wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and can always find previous episodes on archive.org. Please let other Star Trek fans know about this podcast, and leave us a positive review on iTunes. Thank you for listening, and until next time, happy reading.